Let me drop it. And if there's the slightest error in the wiring between the shore side, the power coming from shore onto that party boat that's floating in that water, and you're swimming near that party boat, my goodness, is there a lot of risk in that particular situation. The voltage gradient across that water can electrocute you even though you're not touching any other object. There was also another story that we've seen on some of the YouTube videos of where the miswiring of the pump of a backyard pool was creating voltage in the pool, and people were sensing electrocution flowing through their body when they swam in that water of that pool. So, landline power anywhere near a fluid, and a human being is in that fluid, is a very dangerous condition. WS2N to take it with some delay in case anyone else wants to give us some comments. KQLIW in the tech net.
N2APG.
Go right ahead, N2APG. You got it, Dave.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I just wanted to, actually I was going to bring up the topic tonight of ESD, electroshock, drowning, as you mentioned it. I just read an article. It worked. It's actually yesterday. And all the experts recommend that you never, ever swim around a dock, a marina, you know, a boat that's been anchored near a dock or a marina, just for that reason, a straight current. You know, there's been numerous documented cases of, you know, people that have become incapacitated through the straight current and they just drown. So, you know, it's Long Island. A lot of people have boats. People live on canals. You got to educate the kids and supervise them and make sure that nobody, you know, goes swimming around a boat that's docked or anything like that just for that reason.
Good to know. And if you start feeling any kind of tingling while you're swimming in water, best thing I can think of you can do is to try to make a guess as to what's the nearby object that's creating the grief, and make sure you're swimming in the opposite direction, because the voltage gradient across your body will increase probably exponentially as you get closer to the source. So you want to get away from that source, whatever it is. So be careful when your body is in any fluid and there's any possibility of stateside power, of a landline power coming in contact with that fluid. And if the fluid is high enough in conductivity, like seawater, I'll bet you it wouldn't take 120 volts. I bet you a 40-volt power supply with a certain kind of connection into seawater, and a human being is in that seawater, I think it can create grief. WS2N, KQIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, thanks for the information, and to you, Steve, for the information. Now I got an update. I searched the internet, and I wound up with a video, and, you know, on a news report. I think the news report came out of Texas, but the incident was in Lovington, New Mexico. So, apparently, when they come up with these stories, they don't give you enough information. Now it turns out to be a frayed wire on an extension cord. And, all, you know, one bad thing is the bad extension cord, and another bad thing is the lack of the GFI. That's bad news. And the GFI, again, would have protected it even with the 120 volts. No, that's it, Dick. I just wanted to see what your opinion was. Now I got an update on it and everything. Very good. Back to you, Dick.
2HUC with a follow-up comment.
Yeah, HUC Steve, and I'm going to go back to Dave with another comment with him. Dave first. KD2HUC, you got it, Steve.
Yeah, you know, it's very easy to assume that the GFCI would have protected her.
But one thing you have to understand about the GFCI is it's only going to detect leakage current that is coming out on the hot leg and not returning via neutral. You know, in the old days when you had iron drain pipes and copper water lines to the tub, you know, if you were in the tub and you know, an appliance dropped in, there's a good chance you were there was going to be leakage current through the water to one of those piping systems. Nowadays, tubs are acrylic, the piping is PVC, the water lines are PEX, and it's isolated. Any current that flows through your body and happens to go back to the GFI through neutral is not going to trip that GFI. So if she was making contact with both hot and neutral standing on the floor while she's wet, she'd be dead anyway, and the GFCI is just going to see her as load. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, interesting point. And even with insulated piping and an insulated tub, there still is a conductive path by way of the water. Let me think about that. No, not necessarily. If you've turned off the water, there isn't a continuous stream of water between your main input to the house and the tub, and the drain also doesn't have any continuous connection. So if the whole tub is plastic, it could be quite a bit safer. But like you got a point. If she's coming in contact with the hot and the neutral, she is just an increased load and might not trip the GFI. However, with a stray cord, can you think of a way that the cord that has strip insulation could create voltage across her body such that she creates a load without a balanced load without tripping the GFI? Can you think of a way that strip insulation on the extension cord could do that, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. The picture that was, with the article showed one of those, dollar store lamp extension cords. No ground conductor, just a simple two-wire. And so one hot, one neutral. And if her body is soaked in water, which now has picked up, salt from her skin and whatnot, as you pointed out, just putting your hand across both those wires could produce voltage gradients right across her skin in that water. So, and because there's no ground, the only thing she could get between would be hot and neutral if there was no other path, through any other object she was touching.
Yep. So that even in that case, a perfect operating GFI might not trip. Because it's a balanced load, she's just a load. Now, Dave, you will come in contact with people who know an awful lot about seaside recreation people. As such, if a lightning storm is coming to your neighborhood and you're swimming in salt water, and if that lightning strikes the salt water, let me pick a number, 2,000 feet away, I think the gradient you could get across that seawater could be a dangerous condition for a human being that's in that seawater. I wonder if you've ever heard anything along those lines, Dave. I am guessing there's a strong recommendation that when a thunderstorm is coming to your area, everybody at that beach should get out of the water. That's my guess as to what's the proper operation. N2APG, K2RIW.
N2APG, Dick, where I work at the beach, the policy is that if anyone hears thunder or they see lightning, that the beach is closed, everyone comes out of the water, and everyone must leave the beach.
So the most dangerous condition would be in the water. If I'm on my blanket on the sand, 50 feet away from the water, am I still in danger? In other words, only in my automobile am I safe? The fact that there's completely flat land around me and flat water, so to speak, are you telling me that I'm even at risk on my blanket on that sand? N2APG, K2RIW.
Well, you may not be at risk from the transmission of the current through the water, but you're certainly at risk of being struck by lightning, because the beach obviously is rather flat. You certainly don't want to be anywhere near a lightning strike. So that's the policy that we have on the beach. Everyone must leave the beach, go up to the parking lot, hang out in the parking lot, whatever, but no one is allowed on the beach. And then we have to wait, I think it's a minimum of 30 minutes until the last evidence of lightning before the beach gets opened up again. And that frustrates a lot of people. And I personally have seen a lightning bolt hit the ground probably almost an hour after a storm left the area. Literally an hour after the last evidence of the storm. Bright, sunny day, and it, you know, it happened right in front of me. Lightning bolt came down and just blasted. I was stunned.
Hey, give us a few more words on this one, Dave. Were you in your automobile in the parking lot looking out toward the beach and the water, so to speak, and you saw this lightning bolt? Or were you actually on that beach itself? How close was that lightning bolt? And after the bolt did hit, you're a curious enough guy that maybe you walked over to that area and wanted to see what damage it did to the land. So describe what you saw and where you were. QAPG, KQRIW.
Well, this probably goes back about 10 years ago. I was in a vehicle parked in a parking lot at a park which is adjacent to the beach. So the beachfront is only, you know, a quarter mile away. And a thunderstorm had come through, and it had gone out to sea, and I had watched it go out to sea. And, you know, I was following it, and it had cleared up, the sun came out. Like I said, it was probably almost an hour after the storm was gone. I mean, the storm was way, way, way out to sea. There was just no evidence of it left. And it wasn't raining. The sun came out. It was a beautiful day. And I was watching some guys actually playing soccer on a soccer field. And there it was, just an air-to-ground lightning strike, a big bolt, just out of nowhere, just all by itself. And, it was really scary. And thank goodness none of the soccer players were hit, but it was in that general vicinity, you know, where they were playing soccer on the ball field. And, all the experts will tell you that you can get a lightning strike, way after the storm moves out, and until you see it for yourself, you just don't really believe it. But, yeah, I saw it. Just wacky stuff.
How many feet from you was that lightning strike? And did you, with your curiosity, walk over there to see what damage it did to the ground? Or were you, Dave?
No, I didn't go check it out. I would think that it was probably within about a half a mile of where I was sitting. Probably, in between a half a mile to maybe a mile away. But, it was right in front of me in my line of sight, and I could clearly see the bolt come down, and the bang was pretty instantaneous.
Make a rough guess as to how many seconds there was between the flash and the bang. Dave, go ahead.
Well, we know that the sound travels at about a mile every 5 seconds. So, this was probably about a second or 2 seconds after the I saw the flash. It was pretty close.
1 or 2 seconds is 1 or 2,000 feet. That is pretty close. And I presume it hit land, not water. And was it closer to the soccer players than it was to you?
Yeah, it was in the general vicinity of the soccer players. That's what I was watching. I was watching these guys play soccer, and bam, there's this bolt. And I was afraid right off the bat. I was afraid that the soccer players maybe got zapped, but they appeared to be okay. I guess it was wasn't right in front of them, but it was scary stuff. And you know, like I say, when you actually see it happen, it's mind-boggling because it was absolutely clear out. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. And like I said, the storm was way gone, way gone. It was, you couldn't see it. It was just far out to sea. And the time frame was, you know, probably close to an hour. And there it was, just an isolated, you know, lightning bolt, just by itself. That was it.
There's a golf course in Bethpage, Long Island, the so-called Black Course. And I was a caddy there way back in the 1954 time frame, 55, somewhere around there. It seemed like every year, a couple of the golfers on the Black Course would be struck with lightning. Almost every year, a couple of them were struck. I think there was a couple of high hills that were very vulnerable. So there were certain places. My grandfather used to own a farm in Glen Cove, and his farm was often struck with lightning. So there were certain areas that lightning likes to strike. Okay, it's time for space report number 259. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2N. T2RIW, protect that.
Okay, Doug. Couple of items that occurred this week. NASA has teamed up with Japan, JAXA, that's the Japanese Space Agency, and they plan on flying another telescope. It's an X-ray telescope. A couple of years ago, there was an X-ray telescope that Japan launched, and it didn't work out too good. The telescope got to 350 miles up, and it started to spin, rotate. And, you know, it's an X-ray telescope, so it's pretty massive. But when it was spinning, the thrusters apparently malfunctioned, and it just kept going faster and faster. And through centrifugal force, it just blew itself apart. You know, the solar panels came off, and the power supply, and everything separated. And that was completely destroyed. They know that by looking at it with radar. But now, probably within a couple of years, Japan and NASA will get together to launch another one. Not an exact duplicate, but something very close. Let me drop it. The one that was destroyed was the Hitokomi's HITOMI. That's the one that was destroyed, and now they have another one. This one's going to be called the X-ray Astronomy Recovery Mission. And it's called a CHARM, but it's letters X-A-R-M. They're pronouncing it as CHARM. So this is going to be a replacement for it. Different wavelength than the Chandra X-ray telescope. And it's also a different one than the New Star telescope. New Star was launched by a Pegasus rocket some years ago by Orbital ATK. They put that up in the air. And that's the one with this extension. It's a 30 some odd foot piece of, you know, extended from the viewing part of the telescope to the DVD, to, you know, so they can record it. They have this, they need a very long distance on some of these X-ray telescopes. And that was the case with the one that got destroyed. But this time they're going to drop that particular frequency that they need, that they would like to have. They're not going to put it in. So it'll be less expensive to launch it, and they're just going to use the existing New Star telescope that's been up there that was put up by the Pegasus rocket as a fill-in. So this way, they'll meet all the objectives that the original one had, but failed. But much much less expensive to launch it. It'll be launched by an H-2 Japanese rocket from Japan. So NASA will come to the rescue to help them out. And they'll put the cost on that. We'll drop it. China has had a problem with their Long March 5, their heavy lift vehicle. I mentioned this last week. First stage, everything was fine. Second stage, they had a problem with that. They haven't made a report on what went wrong, but they need this one. It's a new one of their Long March rockets. All their rockets are called Long March, and they have Long March 1, 2, 3, and this is the fifth version. And they're going to need this eventually to launch a mission to the moon coming up this November, a couple months from now. It's going to be called Chang 5. They want to land on the moon and be able to pick up a couple of, like a pound or so of soil, regolith on the moon, and put it into a canister and then blast it back to Earth. So they're up to that stage. You know, they've had Chang 1, Chang 2, 3. Let me drop it. 1 and 2 years ago were more or less orbital reconnaissance type missions, and then 3 actually landed. Chinese rover on the moon, and it drove around for quite a while. Took pictures of the lander itself. Did some astronomy, and eventually it failed after quite a few months. So they're really pushing along. This next one in November will be a sample return mission, and then they have future ones. The next one, Chang 6, plan on landing on the dark side of the moon, and then actually having a sample return from the far side of the moon. This is WS2F. So that's Japan's story and China's story. Now for Russia. Russia has been launching Soyuz rockets like forever. Different iterations over the last, I don't know how many decades, since their first orbital satellite, since the Sputnik was not launched by a Soyuz rocket, but it was a version of it, an early version of it. I would think after all this time they would have no problems with the boosters coming down. The boosters land on land. They send crews out to return, you know, to get the boosters. And they're pretty good at not hitting anything. And they did the same thing this time too, but they free fires all the time. And, you know, with the engine so hot. So it turns out it was a windy day in Kazakhstan that day. They launched from Kazakhstan. And these fires swept the wrong way and wound up killing a couple of their people that go out and get these boosters. So I think they're going to write in some more flight rules that certain things, you know, not only weather but wind. Not only at the launch pad, but downrange. This happened to be a Soyuz rocket that was putting, I believe that was a Progress launch. Now, they do have successful launches. They just launched one the other day with 73 satellites on board, and that's easy enough for me to remember, 73. Some of the satellites, they come from different countries, including the United States. NASA put something on there. But there's another one that was put on there by Russia that when the satellite gets up, it's like a big tube set. It's going to open up a reflective surface. It'll be four triangles that will open up into a tetrahedron shape, a pyramid type of thing is going to come out of the satellite. And each side is supposed to be 4 square meters big. It's very reflective. They believe it's going to be more visible than the International Space Station. Now, if you've seen that ever go overhead, you know how bright that is. I just can't imagine this thing being that bright. And because it's attached to the hedron, it's going to be rotating. So, unlike the space station, drop. That's very steady in brightness as it goes over. You know, like a cloud or something that's in the way. But the brightness is very steady. I've seen it many times. This thing is going to be twinkling like a star because it will be slowly rotating. I thought that was strange. But 73 satellites, they didn't quite break the record. India broke the record about a year or so ago with 104 satellites. I don't know, I'm not a big fan of them doing what they're doing with all these hundreds and hundreds of small satellites, because a lot of them, you know, eventually do deorbit, but a lot of them don't, and you're creating quite a mess up there. So I hope they cut back on these small CubeSats to some degree, unless they know they're going to deorbit. A lot of the ham satellites have gone up, they'll stay up for a couple of weeks, they'll just deorbit. And some of these, they just transmit. Some of them aren't even transponded. And they'll come down in a couple of weeks or a couple of months. Let me drop it. And last thing I wanted to bring up is the email that you sent me, Dick, about Moon Express. Moon Express has been a company. They've been around probably for 10, 11, 12 years. And this guy, Richard, he owns it, and he's part of the, he's one of the many companies that have been competing for the Google Prize, the Google Lunar Prize. The Google Lunar Prize is what you would get if you get your spacecraft somehow to the moon, land on the moon, take pictures, and eventually move to a different location, and it has to be over 500 meters away from the existing location, and then start taking pictures and video, sending video back to Earth. And this guy has a chance. A lot of them have dropped out. Different countries have been involved, different companies, but this guy is still at it. He's got his rocket ship built. That's going to land on the moon. Drop. It's got four legs on it. It's got one engine that it's going to have a controlled landing with. It's going to land, and instead of like these other companies, are going to have a little rover come out and go 500 meters away. And that's this guy is going to relight the engine, fly 500 meters away, and then land again, and then take pictures and video and send it back. He plans on landing by the end of, launching by the end of the year. The Google Prize, you have to launch, or at least have a contract by the end, to launch by the end of the year. If you succeed, you get $20 million. But he says, even if he doesn't make it, it doesn't matter. He's going to continue to launch future rockets like this, similar to what he built. And then some other ones that are a combination of these, you know, will land. Eventually, he wants to send lunar stuff back to Earth. But that probably won't happen until three or four flights that he makes starting this year. Glenn's going to do the first one, so that will probably take 3 or 4 years before he has a return mission. How he plans to get there, he doesn't have his own rocket that he's launching from Earth. He's contracted with Peter Beck of Rocket Labs. Rocket Labs is a new company to launch rockets, orbital rockets. They've been around for probably 10, 11 years too. They've been in development, and he's launching this. Rocket Labs company is launching this rocket called the Electron rocket. And so far, he's had one semi-successful flight. Built his own launch complex on the North Island of New Zealand, and he did this a couple of months ago. It was successful. Got off a launch pad. He has 9 Rutherford rockets going, and then eventually he goes to Miko main engine cut off, and then the second stage takes over, which is one of these rockets, and that's where eventually something fouled up last time. So his first test flight was semi-successful. He's got another one coming up probably this month or next month. But he's got to get this operational. For Moon Express to have a launch by the end of the year. And NASA already has a deal with this company, Rocket Lab, to put a small payload on its rocket. So it's just another company that's going to be launching rockets. There's many of them. Back to you, Dick, WS2M for the space portion of the TechNet.
Kind of amazing to me that XARM can be pronounced CHARM, X-ray telescope. When it comes to a telescope with an improper launch where it starts spinning, reminds me of two of the NASA missions. I believe there was a Gemini mission in which they tried to do a link up and instability started happening and some tumbling started happening. But I think there was an Apollo mission where, as the command service module got close to the moon, something went wrong and a very rapid spin occurred. I'm not sure whether or not Armstrong was the command pilot at the time, but the command pilot very rapidly had a flip switches on that instrument panel before the spin rate got so fast that the astronauts would be unconscious. He had to stop the stuck thruster. He had to stop its action and then eventually do an opposite thrusting action to stop the spin. But the spin was starting to go faster and faster. Do you remember either of those missions, Paul? Maybe I've got some of the memories mixed up. That's a very dangerous condition. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, that would be Gemini 8. And like you said, Armstrong was in there with Dave Scott. And they wound up with a thruster that was stuck in his service module behind them. They didn't know that. They just knew they were starting to spin. But before that happened, the mission was sit on the launch pad, get ready for launch. There was a launch by an Atlas rocket, which put the Agena spacecraft. The Agena was the target vehicle. So now the Agena got into orbit. After it's in orbit, that same day, they launch the Gemini rocket with two people on board, Scott and Armstrong. And the goal is to dock the thing. That'd be the first actual docking between two vehicles. Agena, of course, is unmanned, and it had a docking collar. And it came up to it. Everything went fine. He docked with the Agena. After a while, though, he noticed he was starting to rotate. And it's because the thruster in the service module behind him was stuck. And you know, in the open position. And they just started going faster and faster to the point where they could almost, like you said, almost, they tell them it's blackout. And Armstrong knew exactly where the switches were, of course. You know, he thought it was Scotty, but Armstrong was the commander of that mission. He reached up and he was able to shut. Actually, I think he put on a couple of other rockets to compensate for it. And then eventually shut down that thruster. And with that, they started to run out of hydrogen fuel.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I think they had some 18 to 30, 20 thrusters on the spacecraft. And the hydrogen eventually started to go low because of this, all these firing of the engines. Him trying to compensate for it. So, by doing that, the mission was over. And it only lasted, what, that one day? And it was supposed to be a multi-day mission. So, they learned a lot from that. He got himself out of that jam. The other mission that was talking about, I'm not sure about, Dick. I don't remember them getting stuck around the moon, starting to spin violently or anything. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was an Apollo mission where a spin took place. Now, a stuck thruster is going to thrust continuously. Maybe he can cycle that particular thruster, give it another on-command, and hopefully the next time he commands it off, it'll really go off. Either that or he's got to find another valve that stops the hydrazine from going to that thruster. What do you think he did? Do you think he cycled that particular thruster, or do you think he found another valve to stop that particular thruster? How do you think Armstrong solved that one? Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
He compensated with using these other thrusters. I think they were retro thrusters. Because of that, they were running out of fuel. The mission was over. They couldn't extend the mission. By the way, when these two vehicles were docked together, I neglected to say that as they were spinning slowly. They thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with the Agena rocks, you know. The Agena had thrusters too. Maybe there's something wrong with that. They didn't know that theirs was stuck. So they undocked, and when they undocked, that's when they started really spinning. So, you know, now you don't have the weight of the Agena on the other end. And that's where they really took off, and it became a life and death situation. So, problem is they of course wish they could have had that thruster, you know, back on Earth to investigate it, you know, what the problem was. They never found out. Like I said, it was in the service module. So if you look at the Gemini spacecraft, you know, it's got two people, they sit side by side, and then behind them is the heat shield, and behind the heat shield setup is this big white piece, service module that contains fuel and oxygen, and it contains fuel cells, electricity, and, you know, all the equipment, and all a lot of thrusters that you need, and that's where the thruster was sitting. Well, when they re-enter Earth's atmosphere, the service module is separated. And therefore, they don't bring that back. So they never really found out for sure from what I read there.
And to use a thruster on the opposite side to stop the spin, I can slow down or stop the spin, but that thruster is going to keep right on thrusting. You have to somehow kill the fuel going to that thruster. If you can't cycle that thruster and get it to seal again, and he's got to find a mysterious valve somewhere to stop the fuel from going to that thruster. So just blasting with the opposite direction thruster is only a very temporary and a very wasteful solution. I wonder what he really did on that one. And thank goodness he had enough knowledge of how that whole system is wired to know what switches to flip. The thruster that was leaking was not being commanded on. Therefore, all the instrument panel probably didn't tell you what's happening. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about it. I know he fired a couple of thrusters to compensate. So whether or not that the one that was kept firing shut itself down, ran out of fuel, I don't know. The valve might have shut. There was nothing that I know that he did. It's not like he said, okay, I'm going to shut this off and it worked. By firing these other thrusters, slowed down the spin, and then eventually regained control over it. And a lot of articles that you read about Apollo 8 talk about it just like that, but they don't go into the fine detail, unfortunately.
You said Apollo 8, did you mean Gemini 8? Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, Gemini 8. That's exactly what I mean. Apollo 8, that was a orbital mission. Three men around Earth, and then eventually blasted themselves to the moon. That was Borman and Lowell was on that one. And Bill Landis.
If I'm correct, Apollo 8, isn't that the one that went on Christmas Eve, figure eight around the moon? It went into orbit around the moon. They read Genesis from the Bible, and after a few orbits around the moon, they did another burn and came back to Earth. I think that was Apollo 8. There, I'm not sure. But it did occur on Christmas Eve, and it was the first time that mankind had ever gone out of Earth orbit around another body. So that had to be Apollo 8, 9, or 10. I think it was Apollo 8. Over you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yes, that was Apollo 8. And it went out there with no limb attached. The lunar module that was not ready at that time, so NASA did it very progressive. They had Apollo 7, that was just orbital, test out the Apollo vehicle itself, make sure it maneuver and do what it had to do to stay up there for seven or eight days, and then return. Apollo 8 left Earth orbit out to the moon. That was the Genesis, the reading of the Genesis from the Bible. But they wanted to see if they could go around the moon and come back without a limb. They didn't know that the limb could really be a good lifeboat, which eventually occurred. And then Apollo 9 was another Earth orbit only mission. Let me drop it. Which Russell Schweiger was on. That was to actually test out the first limb. So all of Long Island was watching that at the time to see how the limb was going to do in Earth orbit. And they would undock, and they would dock, and they would undock and dock and check everything out. Naturally, that one didn't come back. It didn't have a heat shield, so just the Apollo 9 came back. And then Apollo 10 was dress rehearsal for the moon. Eugene Cernan was commander on that. Oh, wait, he wasn't commander. That was Saturn was commander. Cernan went, was one of the guys that went. And they took Apollo 10 out to the moon and duplicated what Apollo 11 would do. They separated from the command module and dropped it. As they were going around the moon, they separated, even took the limb close to the moon. The only thing they didn't do was land and then redocked with the command module. They actually did a duplicated, tested out an abort mission where the bottom stage separated from the top stage, and they docked with the command module and came home. We know what happened after that with Apollo 11 landing on the moon, Apollo 12 landing on the moon, Apollo 13 didn't make it. And they were glad they had that 11 for a lifeboat. 14 took Shepard. They landed. He got reinstated. He had a gear problem. So he was the first American in space. He finally got another chance to go into space. And where did he go? He went to the moon and walked on the moon. And 15 was the first time they brought the car up the lunar rover. The same with 16, and 17 was the last mission. Do you think we're going back anytime soon, Dick? WS-20.
No, I don't, Paul. I don't think Congress is going to fund any lunar mission for the next 10 or so years. 10 or 20 years is my guess. Because Congress is going to ask the question, hey, we're not in competition with the Soviet Union. We've already got 800 some odd pounds of lunar material. And as you probably know, you may have read that Neil Armstrong collected some of the lunar dust. It's in a plastic package. It's in a larger container of some kind. And somehow it ended up in somebody else's hands. And it got reinstated to NASA, and it's now about to be sold for historic value. And they predict somebody's going to pay somewhere between $2 and $4 million for the sample of lunar dust that Neil Armstrong had collected. I'm amazed that somebody will pay that kind of money for dust. But in the case of Apollo 10, where the lunar module, let me drop it. Lunar module went into a lower orbit around the moon, undocked from the command service module, went to a lower orbit for some number of orbits, and then came back up and docked with the command module again. Because the lunar module at a lower orbit moves faster, that means the total number of orbits it made around the moon was at least one or more orbits than the command module. So if you count the number of orbits, the lunar module had to make a greater number of orbits to come around again to back where you could dock with it. So do we know how many orbits the lunar module made and how many orbits the command module made? Rough number on Apollo 10. WS2N, K2LIW.
Oh, I don't know. My guess is probably, could it be a half? No, it would have to be one. Well, they could go halfway around the moon. I don't know, Dick, but I'd have to read the Apollo 10 transcript. See how they did that. But that was the dress rehearsal. Sarin said, all we needed to do is go a little further and we could have landed on the moon, but the story is, I don't believe it, but they said there wasn't enough fuel, so if they did land, they knew they wouldn't be coming back. Somebody hyped up the story. Back to you there.
It is possible that the total number of pounds of fuel put on the lunar module for Apollo 11 was greater than Apollo 10. So maybe there really wasn't enough fuel. Then again, it was a practice mission. Remember the very first time that on Gemini they tried to do a link-up in Earth orbit? The very first attempt to do a linking, as I remember, was unsuccessful. That you may be looking at an Agena that's a couple of miles ahead of you, and common sense would be that you do an ordinary burn so that you're moving yourself in that direction. But the crazy aerodynamics or astrodynamics are such that you increase your velocity toward an object that you're in orbit with, make your orbit go to a larger radius orbit from the Earth's center, which means you slow down. So at first you'll see you're getting a little bit closer to the Agena. You sense that you're getting into a higher orbit, and pretty soon Agena is starting to move away from you. You have to do the opposite. You do a retro burn, as if you're trying to move yourself away from the Agena. You go to a lower orbit, but it's faster orbit. You go under it, and then you reverse the procedure and come back up to the Agena. So the very first time they attempted to do a docking, I believe it was a real eye-opening piece of science being taught to them, because the very first attempt, I think, was unsuccessful on that whole mission. I think they used up all of the maneuvering fuel and did not do a link-up. Did I remember that wrong? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that would have been Gemini 5. And yeah, the 4 was the Space War. 3 was the first Gemini mission. But yeah, that would have been 5. The 6 and 7, because of the failed attempt to dock with that Agena, what they did was, let me think now. Yeah, that was, Agena actually went, stayed in orbit. Eventually, one of the later missions actually went up and docked with that thing. Or tried to dock with it. Agena didn't have enough fuel anymore. But they actually docked with one and then went up to the other one. I'm trying to think which mission that was. But nevertheless, the six and seven, because of the, I think the failure of 5 docking with it, 6 and 7 created a rendezvous between Gemini 6 and 7. 7 actually launched before 6. We dropped it. So you had, you know, 2 people in each spacecraft. And 6 was up first, and that was Lowell and the guy from I became president of Houston State, of Houston Airlines. I'll think of his name. Begins with a B. You'll probably think of it. Well, they were in Apollo, Gemini 6. Gemini 6. And, for a long duration mission. And 7 went up. Came close to within a couple of feet. They had no docking collars, but they just wanted to see if they could successfully rendezvous. And they went further apart, they went closer together, they played around for quite a bit, and then eventually the same one, 7 came back and 6 kept going around for a long duration, 14-day mission, to see, you know, if man could survive that long. Back to you.
Do you believe the astronauts wore the exact same chunk of clothing for all 14 days, or did they have multiple sets of clothing they could change into a bulger?
Well, yeah, that's what Lowell said. Him and not the block, it would be. I'll think of it. They're sitting in 2 seats. You can't even stretch your whole body out at one time. You can stretch your legs out, and then you can, like, pull your legs together, and then you can stretch the top part of your body out. So they said it was like living in a Volkswagen, a cramped Volkswagen for 2 weeks. So, that's exactly the way it was. Back to you, Dick.
Do you believe they were able to change their clothing during those 2 weeks, Paul? Or do you think they wore the exact same clothing for 2 weeks? Because I see certain unpleasant characteristics here if it was the second.
Oh, yeah, they said it was bad news, but they were very happy together. They couldn't care less. They were in space. This is what these guys did. I mean, they would kill each other to get into space. So, from what I understand, they both had a lot of good humor about it. Why can't I think of that guy's name? You know, I keep wanting to say Boeing. It's not Boeing.
The very first time the Apollo mission flew with a lunar module, which I think was Apollo 9 or 10. I think it was Apollo 9. So they were in Earth orbit with the lunar module, and I think they undocked and docked with it just to prove that they could, probably climbed into it and so on. And because the lunar module didn't leave Earth's orbit, and it had no heat shield, they had to come back through Earth's atmosphere and burn up. And I presume they carefully adjusted that trajectory so that it burned up over the Pacific Ocean. Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, KGYW?
Yeah, that's where everything gets burned up over the Pacific Ocean. For that. But, yeah, Apollo 7, that was just orbital. The only thing that they burnt up over the ocean there would be the service module. And then Apollo 8, well, that's the one that went to the moon. 9. I assume the Lemma eventually came down and burnt up over the Pacific as well.
And I've read recently that much of the sheet metal on the lunar module was 1/3 of a millimeter thick. Let's see, a millimeter is around 39 thousandths of an inch. 1/3 of a millimeter is going to be 13 thousandths of an inch. Wow. I'll bet you Buzz Aldrin had some nightmares that if he kicked his foot real hard in a bad dream while he's sleeping in the lunar module on the lunar surface, in theory he could poke a hole in the side of the lunar module and it would be game over. So I think I've read 1/3 of a millimeter was the thickness of the aluminum in order to save weight. Does that sound reasonable? WS2N, K2LIW.
I know it was thin. They said if you hit it hard enough with your hand, you could probably make, you know, go through it. But the way these things are constructed, you know, they're kind of taut, you know. Maybe you'd have to hit it with a screwdriver or something, you know. Even aluminum foil, if you tighten it and make that taut enough, hit it with the palm of your hand. You got to hit it pretty hard to go through it, I think. But I'm thinking of Frank Borman, by the way. Apollo 7, Gemini 7, Jim Lowell. But, there's no showers involved. There's only one vehicle, space vehicle that actually had a real shower on it, and that was Skylab. And that's it, so, yeah, back to you, Dick. No other comments. WS
point. The YouTube videos I've been visiting lately, one of them gives further description of what took place on Apollo 11. On Apollo 11, when they landed on the moon, in order to open the door, which opens inward, they had to drain out all of the air inside of the lunar module. And when they drained out as much air as they could, and there was a little bit left, maybe it was 1/10 of a pound per square inch, instead of the 14 or 13, whatever, you know, they started off at, 5. That little bit of pressure, because you got so many square feet, which is hundreds of square inches, the total amount of pressure on the lunar module door was such that they could not open the door. So either either Armstrong or Aldrin had to peel the corner of the door to let out the remaining air so that they open the door. So they open the door, they climb out, and then for some reason, Bowman. Wait a minute, was it Bowman? Yes.